Welcome back. Our next case is United States v. Gilmet. Judge Sparks has recused himself from this case. Therefore, Senior Judge Stuckey has graciously agreed to sit with the court in this case, and we are very appreciative of his assistance. So thank you, Senior Judge Stuckey. Lieutenant Commander Bradley, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Blair, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Bradley, and along with Lieutenant Horst, we represent the appellant, Chief Gilmet. Chief Judge, I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Less than 3 weeks before trial, a senior judge advocate threatened Chief Gilmet's defense counsel, saying, "I know who you are and what cases you're on, and you are not protected." The government conceded those comments amount to UCI, but it failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the UCI would not affect these proceedings for two reasons. First, Colonel Shaw's comments damaged Chief Gilmet's relationship with his military counsel. And second, the government's curative measures did not target the real harm from Colonel Shaw's comments. Turning first to Chief Gilmet's attorney-client relationship and how it was damaged. The military judge correctly concluded Colonel Shaw's comments created a conflict of interest for Captain Thomas. The military judge found counsel's concerns reasonable and valid. He based that conclusion on a number of objective factors. The military judge found that Colonel Shaw was speaking under the color of authority and his position at Judge Advocate Division at the time of his comments. The military judge found Colonel Shaw's comments directly addressed Captain Thomas and his zealous representation of Chief Gilmet. Counsel had consulted their state licensing authorities and supervisory counsel and found a conflict of interest existed. And the military judge had affidavits from every other individual in the room. All people present left with the same impression, that Colonel Shaw's comments were directed at Captain Thomas because of his representation of Chief Gilmet. And the military judge also correctly considered the personal fears of counsel that were created by those comments. As the Supreme Court has recognized, counsel's representations as to a conflict of interest should be given the weight commensurate with the penalties of misrepresentation. The military judge made a credibility determination as he was best suited to do. This court has recognized that in Gore, in Stone, in cases like that, the military judge is forced to weigh the evidence in front of him. He had numerous affidavits showing the impact of these comments, and he had counsel standing up before him on the record saying the same thing, that they personally feared that their zealous representation of Chief Gilmet would negatively impact their careers. And the military judge's findings went beyond that. He found that Chief Gilmet's relationship with his counsel was materially altered by these comments. The military judge found they created a rift between Captain Thomas and Chief Gilmet. They caused...
The Navy Court seems to have held something in the nature of, "Oh, you silly boys, you shouldn't have believed all this stuff." What do you think of that?
Your Honor,
well, first of all, am I correct?
Your Honor, I would say that that is a correct distillation of the lower court's opinion here. And the lower court's opinion directly conflicts with the military judge's findings of fact.
Right.
The military judge found that Captain Thomas had a significant fear that his zealous representation of Chief Gilmet would negatively impact his career. And the military judge placed great weight on that
representation. Because of the comments about promotion boards, not necessarily I, Colonel X, are going to do you in, but there's a JAG sitting on every promotion board, and he knows what you've been doing, etc.
Exactly, Your Honor. Colonel Shaw's comments were not limited to his ability to impact Captain Thomas's career. Colonel Shaw spoke about the lawyer on the promotion board and the small judge advocate community that could inflict negative consequences on his career and on those careers of defense counsel who were zealously representing clients on high visibility cases, such as Chief Gilman's.
So counsel essentially, and I don't want to get ahead of you in your argument, but essentially what you're saying is that the taint was not cured, that what government put forth did not cure the taint of the UCI.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the reason the government failed to cure that taint is because they failed to address the specific warnings within Colonel Shaw's comments.
So was there any way the government could have cured this? Were there any steps that Major General Bly could have taken, perhaps consistent with Rivers, that would have cured this problem?
Yes, Your Honor, there are many things that General Bly could have done. It's difficult for us to say with certainty whether that would have assuaged the very real concerns of counsel and the accused. But an example is supported by the record. The record suggests that General Bly visited Camp Lejeune to conduct an Article 6 visit after Colonel Shaw's comments. And if perhaps he had held a meeting with counsel and the accused to personally assuage their concerns, to vow to affirmatively protect them from any retribution that could follow, that may have gone a long way.
So it is not the position of the defense that if someone acting under the color of authority makes a statement like this, that it automatically, through various steps, results in dismissal with prejudice. You're saying there may be means to cure a situation like this, but in this particular case, curative steps or adequate curative steps were not engaged.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly our position. And the timing in this case is an important illustrator of why that's likely the case. Colonel Shaw's comments occurred on 18 November, and no official messaging is sent to defense counsel or the accused for weeks. The first real thing they get from the government is their response to the motion to dismiss on 17 December, which includes a number of enclosures. But all of that sends a message that nobody cares about curing the actual harm caused by this UCI. No one cares about addressing the individuals, the counsel, and the accused on this case, and trying to get them to restore the trust within each other and their faith within this system. The government treated this like a paperwork problem. They continue to stack up these affidavits saying, well, and as Judge Suki pointed out, the military judge actually distilled what he perceived the government's argument to be on the record. And he perceived the government's attempted curative measures to be saying, the defense counsel are being snowflakes. They should have just sucked it up and sallied forth here. That's the record at page 236. That kind of approach is not enough to cure the very real fears that were instilled in counsel and the accused.
Counsel, what do we do with the fact that appellant consented to the withdrawal of his military counsel? Let's say we agree with everything he said. We agree with the findings of the military judge that there was a terrible conflict of interest here, that his military counsel couldn't represent him, that he didn't believe his military counsel could represent him, but then he consented to their withdrawal. So they're now gone, right? And he still has his civilian counsel. He could have gotten new military counsel. What was the government supposed to do at that point once he consents to the withdrawal of his counsel?
Your Honor, there's a few ways I can answer that question. The first, and to answer it straight, the fact that the accused consented to this release actually shows the impact of the prejudice on the accused. It shows the severity with which the comments were viewed, and it forced him to make this choice. It caused the accused to question a very once strong attorney-client relationship with counsel that had represented him for 2 years, his individual military counsel, someone who he had specifically requested because he believed it was important to his defense strategy to have a senior Marine defense counsel in this case. The accused then foregoes all of that attorney-client relationship because of these very severe comments. So treat the consent release as part of the prejudice, Your Honor, and the fact that he was forced to make that choice between two different facets of a Sixth Amendment right to counsel is part of the prejudice. This court can certainly consider the fact that there is civilian counsel remaining on this case, but that doesn't change the fact that at the time of Colonel Shaw's comments, Chief Gilmet had an absolute right to retain his attorney-client relationships with Captain Thomas and Captain Riley. And government action caused him to consent to release of his counsel.
Well, you said an absolute right. I mean, it's not absolute, right? Article 38 is not that broad, right? If there could be circumstances, they could have been deployed. There are all kinds of military emergencies that might have required the replacement of his military counsel. I think there's plenty of case law that supports that. I guess the question here is, we have what we'll just call malfeasance by the government that interferes with his right to counsel. Now, I assume what you're really saying is that is something that violated his Article 38 right. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. None of the circumstances that would have allowed for release of counsel were present in this case. They hadn't been transferred to other units or anything. So at that moment, in this context, he did have an absolute right to retain those relationships. And government malfeasance, as you put it, Your Honor, interfered with those attorney-client relationships. And as this court has recognized in cases like Murray and Baca, defense counsel are not fungible. There are certain intangible aspects of an attorney-client relationship that cannot be assessed for future prejudice. There was trust that was built over that two-year period, working on a daily basis on different aspects of the case, interviewing different witnesses that each of the attorneys had not talked to. Those things matter in the context of this case, and courts have recognized that that's very difficult to calculate prejudice moving forward, Your Honor.
Counsel, your answer just then kind of raised the issue. I was going to wait till you got to it, but since you brought it up, you were talking about assessing for future prejudice. So what is your position with regards to the applicability or the application of Reynolds versus Biagazi? Which standard should we be applying?
Your Honor,
if we assume that there's UCI and pick the flavor, which standard should we be applying?
Your Honor, this court should apply the test that it traditionally applies at the trial court level. It should not apply the Reynolds test, because while there is some prejudice in the record, there's still other prejudice that had yet to materialize that's very difficult to assess. But the military judge noted the right standard. He noted that there was a potential for future unfairness in these proceedings. And in order to prevent the case law from becoming a little bit confusing on this point, I recommend that the court still apply the trial court standard. Don't apply the traditional Article 66 flavor of this test, Your Honor.
Counsel, do we need to muck around in prejudice at all? If you posit that he's denied his choice of counsel, isn't that structural error?
Your Honor,
didn't the Supreme Court say so? Denial of choice of counsel was structural error under the Sixth Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has
said... You don't have to get into prejudice, and you don't have to get into all that?
The Supreme Court has said in Gonzalez-Lopez that denial of the right to counsel of choice is a structural error, but that is a doctrine that's normally applied on a post-trial review. In the context of this interlocutory appeal, the military judge didn't find it was structural error. What he found is that the attorney-client relationship was severed because of government action. The government had interfered with an already established attorney-client relationship, and he could not fully assess the prejudice that would continue to...
There was prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And okay. I'm saying you can do it either way. You can find that there was prejudice because of what the government did. Or you can just say... It's structural error. Goodbye.
Yes, Your Honor. And ultimately, it's the government's burden to prove that this UCI has been cured, that the taint in these proceedings is no longer. And it has failed to carry that burden with its curative measures that failed to address the specific harm here. None of the curative measures were directed at the parties who were impacted by this UCI. General Bai's affidavit was provided to the counsel in the companion litigation to this case and doesn't mention Captain Thomas or Chief Gummett by name. It doesn't really acknowledge what was said and how that impacted the parties involved.
Now, the government says that the military judge circumvented the UCI analytical framework by excusing counsel before really providing the government with an opportunity to rebut that. Could you explain why the government is wrong in that analysis?
Your Honor, that's not how this played out, because the military judge treated these issues very carefully. He was trying to keep them in separate boxes. So at first, when they come on the record, he has a colloquy with counsel to get the information he needs to assess this conflict of interest that he has already seen is apparent based on the affidavits he had been provided before the 39A session and the information that he had from the motion. So once he's had that discussion with counsel, he then turns to the accused, because he also needs to find out what prejudice or what impact this had on Chief Gilmet and whether he wanted to continue forward with this counsel. The military judge was very careful because he was aware of precedent such as Baca and Watkins where it matters what the accused actually wants to do with their counsel. Perhaps Chief Gilmet would have wanted to waive that conflict. The military judge needed that information in order to assess the situation. But after counsel was released, the military judge gave the government ample opportunity to cure this UCI. They were still permitted to argue the motion. They were allowed to file additional briefing, and they held a second 39A. So in that time, the government had the opportunity to convince the military judge that perhaps this conflict was unreasonable. But the military judge disagreed with the government based on the evidence presented by both parties. And it's not accurate to say that they didn't have a chance to cure this conflict, also because of the timing of how this played out. The comments occurred on 18 December. They had over a month until this first 39A to produce any number of curative measures that might have addressed the real harm here. But what it looks like is the government was trying to do just enough to get itself out of a very tough litigation position, and it wasn't directing that curative measure at the people impacted by this UCI. This is a very difficult type of UCI to cure because of the fundamental nature of the attorney-client relationship in the fairness of military justice proceedings. And when this UCI is committed by senior judge advocates, it gets even harder. And the government's burden gets harder still when the original speaker invokes their 31 Bravo rights and directs communications through legal counsel. Normally in these cases, such as Rivers and Douglas and Sullivan, you see the original speaker retract their own comments and do something to assuage the fears of those people intimidated by their comments. But that's not what we have here. That's not the showing the government made, and that's why it failed to meet its burden, Your Honor.
Now, dismissing with prejudice is uniformly recognized as being a drastic remedy. Why was that the only remedy in this particular case?
Your Honor, I see my time's about to expire. May I answer?
Please proceed.
That was not the only remedy in this case. The military judge did consider a range of options, and he believed it was the appropriate remedy. But the remedy itself is not contained within the issue before this court today. The government did not challenge the remedy below, and we asked this court to decide whether the government met its burden to prove beyond a reasonable
doubt. So in that regard, the government did not discuss this in its briefing. Is it your position that they waived this
issue? Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
More questions from the bench? Thank you. Captain Blair?
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Captain Tyler Blair, and along with Colonel Joseph Jennings, I represent the United States. This court should find the military judge abused his discretion for two reasons. First, the military judge erred in finding actual UCI because the government had met its burden in rebutting the UCI claim through its five actions. Second, the military judge erred when he applied apparent UCI. And regardless, the government met its burden to rebut any apparent UCI claim. To the first point, the military judge erred in how he conducted the proceedings, in his application and conclusions of law, and his findings of fact. The military judge.
Can we start at fundamentals? What was Colonel Shaw's purpose and intent as an 06, talking to these junior 03s? What was he trying to convey to these 03s when he made that host of statements?
Your Honor, and to break that down a little bit, Colonel Shaw was there receiving the command investigation, and through the various affidavits, he was there as part of an outreach for a judge advocate division. And as far as your point about what he was saying specifically.
I couldn't understand what you said. There was outreach for what?
Outreach for judge advocate division, Your Honor. So it was an outreach.
As a run-up to an Article 6 visit, is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. So it was talking to judge advocates about their career prospects and their futures in the Marine Corps.
Sorry, go ahead.
And during that process, counsel had questions about their careers and career
prospects. That's all clear from the record. My point to you is we know what Colonel Shaw said, all of it, not just what was cited by the investigating officer. And I'm asking you, what in the record would indicate to us what the purpose and intent was by Colonel Shaw in 06 making these comments to these junior 03s who are serving as defense counsel, other than what is plainly evident on the face of the statements themselves?
Colonel Shaw's statement, Your Honor, talks about how...
So you're referring to his statements in terms of his affidavits, not his statements?
Yes, Your Honor, how they clarified and expanded on what he was saying, Your Honor.
You're talking about his affidavits?
Yes, Your Honor.
Those affidavits where the military judge found, and I wrote it down, that he indicated that they were internally inconsistent, self-serving, and directly contradicted by multiple officers, and those affidavits where Colonel Shaw said, I didn't do anything wrong, and by the way, I'm invoking my rights. Those are the affidavits you're referring to.
Yes, Your Honor, and those issues that counsel and the affidavits take up with the statements themselves are one thing, but how he explains his actual statements in the context makes sense. He was talking about how if you spend 4, 5, 6 years in the same billet, you will become less competitive for promotion. And so taking that within that context, and again, Your Honor's point about the specific intent is important because the statute changed. Congress put in the specific language of attempt, meaning that an actor must have the specific intent to influence the proceedings. And here, there's no evidence that Colonel Shaw had the specific intent to influence appellant's case. He doesn't.
So when he says, Captain Thomas, I know who you are and what cases you're on, and you are not protected, what he was trying to convey there is, gee, staying in a defense billet for too long might have negative ramifications. That's what we're supposed to read from that statement?
And 2 points to that, Your Honor. I mean, Colonel Shaw's statements were inappropriate, the way they were worded. As far as being not protected, protected from what? Protected from the community knowing that you spent too much time in a certain billet and being less competitive on promotion boards. Because as Captain
Now,
Thomas
the question was posed by Captain Thomas in the context of, with this new structure that's going to be in place with decision-making process for prosecutions, will they be protected in the same way defense counsel are protected? That is the context in which you responded, you are not protected. So you're saying that we should read that as meaning if you stay too long in the billet, that's going to harm your career advancement?
Looking at the affidavit and the whole statements in context, because as numerous affidavits talk about, defense counsel are protected in their FIT reps. They're written by a separate chain of command. This comes down to promotions and slating assignments. And the government's evidence they provided, these 5 pieces of evidence they provided, show that Colonel Shaw was frankly wrong and that he was, since he was removed, he no longer has power to influence those assignments or promotion boards.
But Captain Blair, that's exactly the point, that Colonel Shaw was not just talking about the assignment process. Colonel Shaw specifically referred to promotions and the composition of promotion boards and the fact that it's a small community. Similarly, as a follow-on to the Chief's point with regards to the directness of the comment to Captain Thomas, not only did he say, I know you and I know the cases that you are working on, his illustration with regards to the impact of staying in a defense billet too long, referencing the Iraq cases, the Haditha cases in particular, and the fact that Captain Thomas's co-counsel had been one of those defense counsel who were non-promoted or passed over for selection. I mean, explain to me how that was, how the recipient of that statement was not supposed to take that as a targeted statement to them.
But to your first point, Your Honor, as far as the promotion boards, Colonel Shaw's comments show that he himself doesn't understand how promotion boards in the Marine Corps works.
He's an 06 and he doesn't know?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Colonel Estes, who's in charge of manning the promotion boards for the Marine Corps manpower, talks about how there aren't judge advocates normally on promotion boards.
And yet, he's speaking under color of authority to a bunch of, I was about to say baby jacks, but to a bunch of JAG captains. So we're supposed to say, oh, it's okay for 06 to not know and misrepresent and potentially threaten younger judge advocates, and they should have known better.
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. And again, this all goes to the fact that it all goes to the point that did the government, you know, provide sufficient remedies? We would argue that they did. We're not arguing that Colonel Shaw's comments were appropriate. We're arguing that the government cured any taint for any potential UCI in the remedies that they took. So Colonel Shaw was fired. He was sat down. His ability to influence any slating assignments was removed from him permanently. This was done by a two-star general in the Marine Corps who oversees the entire lawyer community.
All right, counsel, that's all fine. But what we're dealing with here is we have an appellant who doesn't believe his military counsel can represent him. And we have his military counsel who also believe they cannot represent him. So let's just assume, you may disagree with those statements, but let's just assume that's true. Going forward from that point, how do we answer the question of whether or not the appellant was prejudiced going forward?
And Judge Hardy, I think we really have to start with the military judge's failure, first allowing appellant to excuse his counsel. So there was no established conflict of interest on the record. He merely asked, counsel, do you believe you have a conflict? And appellant, do you want to release your counsel? There was no litigation and no colloquy on the record to establish that the UCI caused the conflict of interest.
I don't mean to short-circuit your answer, but on that point, in Holloway versus Arkansas, didn't the Supreme Court essentially say, when you have an officer of the court who is mindful of the serious ramifications of making a misrepresentation on the issue of a conflict, that it isn't sufficient for the trial judge, here the military judge, to accept and adopt the position of defense counsel that he or she is not able to continue with the representation? Am I misreading the Supreme Court in Holloway versus Arkansas?
No, Your Honor, but we're not sure what caused that conflict of interest. Was it counsel?
We know that counsel, in response to questions from the military judge, said they had spoken to their state bar authority and had spoken to conflict-free counsel. So it was not a situation where it was spur of the moment or merely subjective. We do know that they reached out. Now, does the fact that the military judge did not require them to state with more specificity what occurred in those conversations, was that fatal to the military judge's authority and ability to say, I will grant your ability to withdraw at this stage?
Your Honor, again, the conflict of interest in this case could be looked at into two separate buckets. The first one is whether it was Colonel Shaw's comments that directly caused this conflict of interest, or was it counsel's belief that some rogue actor would cause him not to be promoted on a promotion board? And again, the one, the government cured beyond a reasonable doubt through their five pieces of evidence. The other, some subjective belief that, you know, cannot be overcome by any government remedy because it's something that counsel retained themselves. As Griner talks about, Second Circuit talks about, that's something the government can't be expected to cure because it's been disproven, and it merely amounts to a personal subjective conflict from counsel.
How was it disproven?
Yes, Your Honor, going back to the
The two-star gave an anodyne statement about, well, what the colonel said doesn't represent my opinion. That's cold comfort. And other than that, you have, well, he's not going to sit on your promotion board, and he's out of promotion, out of assignments. Well, that's cold comfort. If I were a junior 03, and I once was a junior 03, I'm not at all sure that would warm the cockles of my heart. Now, how is this gotten rid of? How did the government disprove this?
Well, maybe this would warm your heart, Judge, is that the government, you know, presented evidence that several officers were, several senior leaders in the Marine Corps were successful defense counsel, including seven of the last senior judge advocates in the Marine Corps. And they showed for all the current colonels and lieutenant colonels in the Marine Corps, over 25% had served two tours in defense billets.
Okay, well, then on the one hand, the government is trying to say, well, what we really meant is if you spend too much time as a defense counsel, you're going to get screwed. And on the other hand, they're saying, oh, no, X percent of colonels in 05s and 06s spent lots of time as defense counsel. Now, which one is it?
And, Your Honor, getting in, this is, you know, separate defense tours over longer periods of time as opposed to a 5 or 6 year chunk only serving in the same job. And then, moreover, some other things that the government provided, they showed Captain Thomas before Colonel Shaw's comments was selected for highly competitive follow-on orders. And they also provided Colonel Shaw's comments himself before he made those comments, private text message conversations, showing that he was advocating for what Captain Thomas wanted.
Counsel, I feel like the government's presenting all this evidence to say their concerns about the conflict of interest were unreasonable. But let's just say we don't agree with that. Certainly the military judge didn't agree with it. He thought they were reasonable. What is the evidence that the government can present to show, given these concerns, which we believe were unreasonable but the military judge disagreed, we addressed those concerns? What did the government do to address the fact that the military council felt conflicted and appellant believed that they were conflicted? Not what the government did to fix the situation or to demonstrate that they shouldn't have felt that way. Given that they felt that way, what did the government do?
The government took the five steps that I talked about, Your Honor. But, I mean, going beyond that, if counsel retains a belief that's been disproven, the government can't disprove it. And that shouldn't amount to prejudice, incurable prejudice in this case. This is better analyzed under Hutchins, where, you know, this court said that the severance, improper severance of an attorney-client relationship was tested for prejudice. And if the appellant received effective assistance of counsel at trial, and that's really the more appropriate path forward for this case, is this court should send this back down and allow it to continue to see if appellant receives effective assistance of counsel at trial. We don't have findings or sentence in this case to really be able to measure prejudice. And to your question, Your Honor, earlier, your comment about this being structural, it's not structural. The military judge also misapplied Watkins when he applied structural error to this case in finding that the same right to hired counsel, which is what the Supreme Court was talking about in Gonzalez-Lopez, also attaches to the...
Can be analogized to requesting IMC, which is what he did. No, he's not hired. He did hire counsel. So you're saying that structural error only applies to civilian counsel?
To hire...
Any authority for that?
Yes, Your Honor. This court in Spriggs pretty much directly addressed this, that the statutory right for detailed counsel, IMC is still detailed counsel, detailed
right.
Counsel, individual military counsel, don't qualify as a Sixth Amendment right. So, again, this needs to be tested for prejudice or violation of a statutory right. It's not structural.
Now, counsel, that argument is contained in your briefs. And I went back and I looked at, reread the military judge's findings. Even the section where he discussed this, he says he uses the material prejudice standard. So I hear what you're saying about he applied this structural error standard, but yet, it doesn't even require really close reading to discern that, no, he did a material prejudice analysis. I mean, it, like I said, it's captioned as material prejudice. So he cites to some structural error cases, and in many ways kind of not distinguishes them, but says, hey, this is something that supports the fact of the impact or the injury on the relationship between the accused and counsel. So what is the evidence that he actually did a structural error analysis? Because that's not what he wrote up.
Yes, Your Honor, the military judge's actions and the way he did his ruling treated the function as structural error. He ignored all the remedies this court has previously accepted to be able to deal with similar issues in addressing ECI. The military judge, just like this court allowed in Calhoun, could have allowed the government to pay for civilian defense counsel, like the government offered. In that case, the Air Force was investigating defense counsel for alleged misconduct, and all the defense counsel on that base were compromised. And the military judge in this court found that paying for civilian defense counsel was an adequate remedy.
But would that be paying for additional civilian counsel, or are you saying would have paid for Chief Gilmet's current civilian counsel?
It could be either, Your Honor. It's about being able to fund replacement counsel, and the government offered to do either. So again, the military judge functionally treated this as structural error. Again, this goes back to appellant's choice to release counsel was a personal choice, not a result of UCI. By allowing appellant to make the choice to release his counsel without putting necessary good cause on the record, the military judge effectively baked in, instead of giving an appellant could have waived the conflict of interest and allowed his counsel to stay on his case.
Counsel, you've argued that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel here isn't implicated, and let's say we agree with you with that. Why isn't his statutory right to the counsel of his choice, why isn't it implicated?
It is implicated, Your Honor, as far as his statutory right to detailed military counsel and individual military counsel.
Well, was it violated? Then was that right violated in this instance?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, if this court finds that there was, you know, a conflict of interest and it was improperly severed, like Hutchins, then we could find, you know, you would test for material prejudice to the substantial rights. And right now we don't know if his rights were truly violated because this wasn't allowed to proceed to trial. And we don't know what the results would have been as far as the findings or sentence. He could have, just like in Hutchins, he could have gotten additional counsel that could have been trained up, military judge granted continuances, case could have proceeded to trial, and then we would have tested to see if he had received effective assistance of counsel as the Sixth Amendment requires him to receive.
So, counsel, where do you pinpoint the harm? When or where did the harm occur?
In this case, before it proceeded to trial, Your Honor?
Yes.
So if,
or are you arguing there was no harm?
So, like in Hutchins, Your Honor, the harm could be where attorney-client relationship was improperly severed or was severed, you know, as a result of a subjective conflict of interest.
Okay, because that goes back to Judge Hardy's question with regards to we are confronted with counsel who believed that they were conflicted based upon not only their initial sense, but after consultation with their supervisory defense counsel, non-conflict counsel, and their state bars. We're confronted with an accused who had lost trust and confidence in his counsel as a result of the, we'll call it a perceived conflict. And so I'm trying to get from the government where, if at all, do they see the harm occur? Because from your argument, it's as if there was no harm and this case could have gone forward to trial and we would see what happens with findings and sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll clarify. I see I'm over my time.
Please proceed.
Thank you. So to your first comment, Your Honor, about, you know, counsel saying they talked to their state bar and conflict-free counsel, this court should apply little or no weight to those comments because counsel never said that the state bar or conflict-free counsel said that they had a conflict of interest. Second, to your part about where the harm occurs, I would just like to clarify, like in Hutchins, if the attorney-client relationship was severed, there could be harm there. Then we test for prejudice. And like in Hutchins, Hutchins received effective assistance of counsel, and there was no prejudice. And just a last point, Your Honor, appellant wasn't prejudiced because his counsel, even after Colonel Shaw's comments, still continued to zealously advocate for him by putting forward a motion to dismiss with prejudice, alleging the judge advocate community of UCI.
How do we know the civilian counsel didn't write that and the IMC, Captain Thomas and Captain Riley, didn't just sign off on it? That the zealous representation was coming out of the wallet of Captain Gilman.
And we don't know that for certain, Your Honor, but if counsel was really concerned and wasn't able to zealously advocate, they wouldn't have signed the motion at all.
Are there further questions from the bench?
I have one, Chief.
Please.
If we believe that there was UCI and prejudice to the appellant here, is the appellant's counsel says that the remedy imposed, which in this case was a very drastic one, is beyond the scope of our review. That's not something the government's challenged, and it's not fairly before us. Do you agree with that?
If that is the case, Your Honor, the government wouldn't object to this court reviewing that. And
would there be any basis for us to review it? It sounds like, I mean, they argued that it was waived, and if it was waived, we wouldn't review it.
Again, the government challenged the military judge's ruling as far as committing errors in its ruling.
If there was error and prejudice, is it the government's position that the military judge abused his discretion in ordering dismissal with prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, this is...
Where does that appear in your briefs?
And again, Your Honor, again, if this does not appear in our briefs, this court, you know, the government won't object to this court, reviews it. And again, it's like this court has said in Gore, dismissal with prejudice is a drastic remedy, and this military judge ignored all of the remedies that were offered by the government.
More questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Lair. Lieutenant Commander Bradley.
Your Honor, the government tries to extricate part of Colonel Shaw's comments and say that the fears in counsel's minds were somehow caused by a rogue actor. The fears were caused by Colonel Shaw's comments and the consequences that he warned of that could occur based on their zealous representation of Chief. The military judge found but-for causation in this case both ways. He found that Chief Gilmet would never have released his counsel but for Colonel Shaw's comments, and he found that counsel would never have asked to be released from this case but for Colonel Shaw's comments. There's no other external factor that could have caused this conflict of interest. And the government asked this court to apply Hutchins, but that's exactly what the military judge did here, because in Hutchins, this court noted that prejudice is assessed based on who initiates the action leading to the severance. In Hutchins, the severance was caused by defense counsel terminating their service in the military. That's why the prejudice was assessed at trial, because defense initiated the action. But here, the government initiated this action. Colonel Shaw, in his position at Judge Advocate Division, took action which caused the severance of this attorney-client relationship. And second, the government tries to argue that this evidence of senior judge advocates with defense counsel experience is somehow supposed to assuage the concerns of counsel and the accused in this case. But all that evidence shows is who was able to rise up through the promotion process. It doesn't show who was passed over in alignment with the very comments that Colonel Shaw made. They can't prove this issue based on the evidence that they've provided. They've not cured the taint from this UCI. And the government also offers these text messages from Colonel Shaw to try to say that he was trying to do the best thing for Captain Thomas. Those text messages tell a different story. They tell a story about Colonel Shaw personally inserting himself into Captain Thomas's next assignment hours before he makes these threatening comments in a meeting with defense counsel. That does not assuage the concerns. If anything, those text messages make this situation look a lot worse and heightened the concerns of counsel. So finally, if the lower court's opinion is allowed to stand in this case, the public is left with one perception, that the military and that senior officers can bully defense counsel off a case, that defense counsel will not be believed when they offer their genuine representations as to a conflict of interest, and ultimately the accused just has to grin and bear it. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we ask this
court. Now, you're veering there into apparent UCI. Can the defense prevail on actual UCI?
Yes, Your Honor. And for those reasons, we ask this court to reinstate the military judge's ruling pending any further questions.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.